Tuesday we began a series of discussions on medical ethics, right? Maybe you could make that a little softer if you want. Just a little. We started to look at some of the issues behind Jewish medical ethics. Anyone remember? Yesterday we tried to examine whether we are human or not, correct? And I trust you all concluded that we are in fact human, right? We're not biological organisms. We're not going to get into that discussion again because thoroughly proved yesterday, without any discussion, there's no point in getting into it again, right? But the concept is like this, that we certainly can't discuss Torah-based medical ethics unless we have the principle that we are human. If we're just biological organisms in the same sense as animals, then we don't have any basis for a Torah discussion. Because then ethics becomes only whatever that society decides it should be, if they so decide, is that right? And if they decide on euthanasia, then that's what it will be. Correct? Which is what's happening exactly. This suggestion that somebody told me that's taken on in Oregon now. I didn't hear about that yet. But that which is being proposed across the United States now, which is to legalize certain forms of euthanasia. So that's voted into effect, and that will be the law. And if that's the law, it means that's what you'll be allowed to do. And that will be defined as right by society. Is that right? And that, if that's what the standard is, so then that's what the standard is. And there's not a total discussion. Then the criteria become whatever that society decides the criteria should be. And there's no argument you can make for universal criteria. And therefore, we have to lay down the principle that there's something transcending the human level of value assessment before we can get into what the Torah says about ethics. You know, in a democracy, what goes is what the democracy decides. Somebody put it very beautifully. I saw a book, I've written about 20 years ago. Jewish thinker put it this way, a very, very beautiful statement. He said like this, in a democracy, the people make the law. In Torah, the law makes the people. Isn't that beautiful? It's a beautiful statement. We didn't discuss euthanasia, we just mentioned it. And I'd like to rather get into that, if you don't mind, on a separate occasion, as an entire discussion, okay? So I like this discussion. We need to go through, yes, there are circumstances where you can do certain things. You can't terminate a life, but there are certain circumstances where you're not obliged to continue treating. But let's deal with that properly, okay? Let's lay down the principles in sequence, and let's start today with some of the principles of critical decision-making in halakha, right? In terms of saving life. Let's try and chop it up into areas and discuss some of the most important areas. Give me a chance to give you some of the principles and some of the applications without asking any questions, if you don't mind, and then I'll stop for questions. Please note down what you would like to ask so that we can try to deal with it. But first, let's try and study some of the general scenery, background. A fascinating way to approach it is like this. Again, there's many, many things to say here, and many details, end of discussion, but let's maybe try to approach it in the following fashion. In general, you can take home a principle that when it comes to life-saving, the Torah position, the Jewish position, is diametrically opposed to secular values. That's a general principle. The default position in your mind should be that when it comes to spiritual matters, the way the secular world, which is predicates its behavior on biological principles, evolutionary principles, agnostic or atheistic principles, seeing man as an accidentally evolved biological creature, are going to come out with options that are opposite to the Torah way of dealing with it. But what a fascinating insight into this field is to show those areas where we happen to agree. There are some rare cases where in medical dilemmas we happen to agree with the modern secular criteria, almost always for different reasons. But it so happens that the outcome might be the same. Let's see if we can try and trace some of this scene and see what we can learn. So let's start like this. First of all, where do we differ? So the entire principle to be clear about here is that when it comes to saving lives, we're talking today about life-saving issues, right? We're not talking about cosmetic surgery and issues that have got other considerations, or what we might call ritual considerations. We're talking about life saving. The underlying principle in Torah is that life is so paramount, they will never do anything to destroy it, and will do anything to save it. That's the default position. I'm about to show you some exceptions, or seeming exceptions. But the default position in your mind as a Jewish doctor has to be that you'll do anything to save a life, right? And they've proved otherwise, which we'll try and discuss as exceptions. And you do nothing to foreshorten or prejudice a life. Not even subtly. Not even subtly. And Moshe Feinstein writes that even if you're required, even if you as a physician on a situation where you have to do something where the patient's life may be prejudiced in a real subtle fashion. For example, you're disaffecting psychologically negatively when he's in a dangerous life and death situation. That's a prohibition. And it even takes precedence over saving another life. You hear that? No, you don't. Let me give you a scenario. Give you a scenario? Illustrate how extreme we are in avoiding a reaction that is considered actively interfering, right, with a life. That means active euthanasia. How extreme are we about that? You can't be more extreme. Example. Let's say you're tending to a patient, and this patient happens to be terminal. You're dealing with a conscious patient, right? And the patient is terminal. But they need treatment, so you're busy treating them. While you're busy, another patient gets wheeled into your emergency room, right? Or your coronary care unit, or whatever it is, and that patient is dying, but not terminal. That means they have some acute problem which is threatening their life now. They're bleeding to death. If you leave this patient and move over to that one, you'll be able to save their life. Permanently. Stop the bleeding, and they'll be fine. Are you with me? There's no underlying terminal problem. They'll be fine. Now, Moshe writes that the patient you're dealing with, even though the patient's terminal, you may not leave this patient to go across and save that life. Why? Because when you step away from this patient, they may feel abandoned, and they may feel despair. They may feel that they're leaving me because I'm hopeless. And that feeling of hopelessness and despair is an additive lethal component, and that's considered tantamount to actively contributing to this patient's demise. You hear that? And you're not allowed to do that. You hear that? In halacha, despair and pain are considered tangible, lethal, additive factors. Are you with me? And therefore, you're not allowed to do it. Of course, if the patient's not conscious, then you'd be obliged to leave this patient, even though you'd be desisting now from treatment, even life-saving treatment, by the way, and you'd have to walk across and save the other one. We're talking about desisting, we're not talking about an action. You can't switch off a ventilator. You can't switch off a ventilator, he has to take it over to the other patient in need, because that's called killing this patient. Even though the other one could be salvaged and this one cannot. Nothing doing. Are you with me? But to stop treatment, that means your hands are involved. And now you walk away to save someone who can be saved, because this patient can't, that you'd have to do. But if the patient's conscious and they feel the spirit, but Moshe writes clearly in the Shulchan, if a patient is wheeled into the coronary care unit, whatever you call it, the emergency room or intensive care unit, so forgive me if I occasionally slip into South African English, right? In the old world, the emergency room is called the casualty department, mm-hmm. Right? You know, in standard English, in old-fashioned English, right? That's called the casualty department. You've got to speak American, right? The ER. The ER. A colleague of mine once, can you handle 30 seconds of an aside? Yeah? A colleague of mine once went to work in New York, South African. And he went to work in a busy emergency room in a hospital in New York. And he wanted to tell the nurse to take the patient from the emergency room to the operating room on the cart, together with a chart, in the elevator. Right? That's what he wanted to tell the nurse to do. So he gave the instruction the way an English or South African doctor would do it. He said, sister, take the patient from casualty to theatre in the lift, together with the bed letters, on the trolley. So first of all, the nurse almost punched him for being called sister. You know, sister is like a hip, sister is what they call a hip black, isn't it? Huh? She didn't appreciate being called sister. And she didn't know what a lift was either. And theatre, she had visions of wheeling the patient off to the movies. You know, but, you know, so we'll try, for simplicity's sake, we'll translate into American, okay? If your patient, I'm actually right, that if a patient arrives at the emergency room, or the coronary care unit, and the patient has an acute problem, like a cardiac problem or something else, but underlying that, they're terminal. Okay? That means even if you save them now in the short term, they'll die in the medium term, in a couple of weeks or a couple of months. Terminal in halacha, by the way, is 1 year. What's called chayesha'a what defines a patient as being terminal in halacha is a life expectancy of less than a year due to this pathology. That needs more discussion, but that's what we're saying now. So if you have a patient who's terminal, and they have an acute problem threatening their life, and they are first, and another patient's wheeled in behind them, and that patient is eminently salvageable, they have only one problem, which is the acute problem. If you save them, you'll save them permanently. And Moshe writes, you may not wheel aside the first patient to wheel in the second one for the same reason. That patient may feel, I'm hopeless, I'm being abandoned, I'm being set aside because I'm hopeless. That feeling of abandonment may cause that last little bit of will to fight, right, to be diminished. And that's considered tangible, actionable, right, halakhic factor, and you're not allowed to do that. Is that clear? So to prejudice the life in any way, yeah, it has to be very relevant to Scripture, otherwise we hold it till we have finished the scenario. You don't mind, otherwise I just want to be able to get through this. Because every point here raises a whole field and a whole world on its own. Pain also, by the way, just while we're on the subject, I don't want to forget this because I see a couple of people here, medical practitioners. So pain, you should know, physical pain, is also a tangible, lethal factor. And I'll give you a lucky application. Moshe writes a very, very interesting, very beautiful thing. Any practicing doctor will appreciate this. What happens when you have a patient, let's take the following medical dilemma, which is common. Professor Lister, I don't know if you have this in renal medicine. I'm sure you do. Let's say you have a patient who is very sick and they're in severe pain. Okay? And the pain is so severe that you need very serious analgesics or narcotics to control their pain. Such doses that you will endanger their respiration. Yes? You know that when you give these very powerful painkillers, so no medicine is without side effects, and these major narcotics can have major side effects. And in fact, the most powerful of them can depress respiration, and if you give enough, they stop the patient breathing. And you may need so much to relieve the pain that you endanger the patient's breathing, which means their life. That's a common medical dilemma, are you with me? And a patient is in real serious pain, agonizing pain, and the only way you can relieve the pain, there's no question. These drugs are so powerful that if you give enough, you'll anesthetize the patient permanently. You'll definitely take away their pain. But the problem is you may stop them breathing in the process. So the dilemma that he was asked is a doctor allowed to give adequate doses of this analgesia knowing that he may prejudice the patient's breathing, which is an active step that is has lethal potential. And the halakhic principle is you may never do anything that has lethal potential. Do you understand? So what are you supposed to do? Let the patient suffer? By the way, in modern medicine, it's well known that this is a very poorly handled area. This is a very poorly handled area. There's an up-and-coming specialty now of pain relief because doctors are so bad at it. And many doctors are hesitant to give adequate pain relief for fear, for lots of reasons, and one of them, for fear of course you get the other group as well, who deliberately give too much, terminate the patient's life. On the guise of giving analgesia, but actually the famous letter in the Journal of the American Medical Association about a year ago, I think, by a doctor who publicly admitted killing a patient called Debbie. I think the article was called "It's All Over Now, Debbie." The American doctor admitted overdosing his patient with her permission, etc., with morphine, killed her, right? Became something of a hero in the literature. This guy, what? No, that's telling you. Now, that's a real dilemma. What do? You need to give your patient adequate analgesia, but you're falling behind on the analgesia and they're suffering badly because you're afraid that if you give them enough, yeah, they may be relieved of their pain and then stop breathing. So they asked Moshe Feinstein, who was not a doctor, he was only a rabbi, what to do. And he rules as follows, very beautiful and brilliant ruling for doctors. The doctor, that it's an obligation to relieve that pain. And you do not have to worry about the fact that there's a lethal risk involved. You give that analgesia. How much do you give? You titrate your analgesia as accurately as possible to provide the maximum pain relief without overstepping the threshold, which is a delicate balance. It's a delicate balance, and it takes expert handling. And people who are expert at this, who specialize in this, have experience. And by the way, before we even get into this, there's a law written clearly in Shulchan Aruch that no doctor is allowed to treat a patient if there's a more qualified doctor around to do so. You know that? How do you like that? There's a law in Shulchan Aruch, you may not treat a patient if there's somebody better qualified around. Why should the patient get less than the best? Because you want to practice.
The general goes down the
brain? No, because there are lots of exceptions to this, depending on what's available, depending on whether what you're trying to do to the patient is standard or risky. If it's standard, the law does not apply. Only if it's risky, right? Some say that if it's in expert hands, under expert guidance, such that there'll be no loss to the patient, it could be acceptable. We'll have to talk about that principle in a second. But not necessarily. It could be generally to better certain things. But we'll have to talk about that separately. The point is that he writes like this, that provided you're doing it responsibly, that means in the best possible hands, the patient is getting that pain relief with no intention to harm them, only intention, you have to titrate it. How do you deal with the fact that in so doing you may depress the patient's respiration? You may, in so doing, derive the most beautiful, beautiful logic, which will do justice to any practicing medical specialist. He writes like this. The reason you can give medication to your patient which constitutes a risk is because the pain itself constitutes a risk. Isn't that beautiful? The pain itself is risky. A patient who's in agony, right? A really sick patient who's in agony, that pain is a tangible lethal factor. And therefore, when you're giving your analgesia to relieve the pain, what you're doing is you're swapping. You hear what's happening? You're swapping the pain as a lethal factor for the risk of your medication as a lethal factor. That's allowed, because you understand? Because you're not only relieving pain. In relieving pain, you are contributing a life-saving, that constitutes a life-saving modality in a certain subtle sense. And therefore justifies the subtle additive risk of respiratory depression, and the two balance out against each other, and therefore it's a responsibility to do the best you can to relieve the pain. That's a very beautiful way of cutting issues. Question has to be immediately relevant to this point. So you'd not be considered to be liable even spiritually. No, again, you did it. That means you listened to the criteria. The intention was only to relieve the pain. You were the biggest expert available that had a right to be doing that, right? And the patient, and what turned out is the patient terminated. And you ask, if in the spiritual world it's known that really they terminated because you went too far, you relieved the pain, and then some. But it was damn responsible. He writes that is your obligation. On the contrary, if you have a mitzvah in your hands. Again, we're talking about total responsibility, okay, titrated carefully, expert hands, okay, where the pain was considered to be lethal anyway. All medicine's risky. All medicine is risky. Every operation is risky. Every anesthetic is risky. You should be asking me what happens when but you guys call an anesthesiologist, what in old-fashioned English is called an anesthetist. When an anesthesiologist gives an anesthetic and the patient dies, what happens? He killed the patient, right? He, with his own hands, administered the drug that killed the patient. I was doing it to perform a cesarean section on this lady to save the baby, or to save the patient's life from an ruptured aneurysm. The patient dies from the anesthetic, right? So here, what happens? What happens to the doctor? He was acting in the interest of a mitzvah, right? And he had to do it. And he'd be culpable if he didn't. What was he supposed to say? I don't want to save this patient's life. There's an interesting discussion about whether he has to go into exile. Because there's a law of an inadvertent killer. If somebody kills someone else by accident, so that person has to go into exile, which is a fantastic discussion. Does this doctor have to do that? Because after all, he was chosen from the spiritual world to be the agent that caused someone's death, even though it was inadvertent and correct the intention. Is it the same as killing someone accidentally? Yeah, you wasn't doing an accident, you were trying to save someone. That's a fascinating discussion. So I hope I'm whetting your appetite here, right? For what I'm trying to achieve is that those of you who are headed for medical school will decide to spend 7 years in yeshiva first. One looks like 10. Okay. Now, so what have we laid down? A general principle that saving lives is paramount, will do nothing to prejudice it, and will do anything to save it. Fair enough? Now, can we find exceptions to this? Can we find exceptions where we would end up doing what in the secular world might be done, or albeit for different reasons? You see, the criteria that the secular world uses at present are not Torah criteria at all. You're probably well aware, you should be, that in secular medical ethics at the moment, they have postulated a number of principles on which they base their ethical decisions. At present, there are four main principles. This is the purpose of this lecture is not to teach secular medical ethics, but you need to know what we're talking about. There are four principles that they quote. In some places, they quote a few more. Four basic principles which govern all medical ethical dilemmas. Okay, those principles are autonomy, which means that the patient has a right to decide their own fate, their own destiny. They're the last in their hands. Beneficence, which means that the doctor is obliged to be acting in the best interest of the patient. Non-maleficence, which means that he's not allowed to be doing anything which would harm his patient. And fourthly, justice. Not necessarily in those order, although autonomy is almost always placed first. Justice meaning, apart from the other three, is what you're doing just? Does it make sense in society? Is society's cost of saving this life just? justified, etc., right? Does this patient's life justify coming before another patient in objective absolute terms? Well, let's call it objective terms. That's what they call justice. Of course, a moment's thought will show you that none of these four criteria have any Torah validity. None of them. Why? Because none of them, because all of them are autonomy, for example, that the patient has the right to make their own decision. Generally speaking, that doesn't satisfy halachically. Why? Because the secular attitude is that the patient has the right to make decisions about their own life because it's their life. In Torah, we say your life ain't your own. Your life's not yours. You've been given your life and your body, as a trusteeship to God carefully to use to maximum benefit, right? And you're not free to throw it away. Whether you like it or not, that's the Torah attitude you put here, having been loaned your body and your soul, right, for the duration of this life, in order to use maximally to become the most evolved, sensitive, refined, human, developed human being that you can. You're not free to throw it away. That's why in Torah law, suicide is in the same category as murder. In the secular criteria, you should be allowed to commit suicide, that's my life. But in Torah, you're certainly not. Are you with me? And therefore, autonomy means I'll decide is completely irrelevant. The most extreme application of this, of course, would be, I met recently with a surgeon from Oregon, somewhere, from Portland. The surgeon came to see me, he's a urological surgeon, to tell me that he treats a lot of Jehovah's Witnesses. Those Jehovah's Witnesses, we don't pronounce that word, right? You with me?
Yeah.
And they do not allow themselves to receive blood transfusions. He's a surgeon. Sometimes in surgery there's blood loss, and he has to give blood. And sometimes when he works in an emergency situation and the patient's bleeding, he has to give blood. Now, according to American law, if I'm not mistaken, certainly according to the principle of autonomy, you can't give blood to a person who doesn't want it. That's his right. That's his religious principle. Right now, what is going on is a court battle about whether you can give blood to his minor child. Because when this judge witness tells you that he doesn't want his 3-year-old, does not want his 3-year-old child to receive blood, right, because of religious conviction, there's been a very interesting battle in the United States court about whether the person has jurisdiction over his child's life or not. The last ruling I saw, and I believe it's still current, is that the court ruled against these people. In other words, that the doctor is allowed and obliged to save the life of the child in contravention of the parent's religious issues, and the ruling that I saw was stated as that the state has an interest in the life of the child which overrides the parent's religious convictions. You hear that? Which means that when it comes to your child, we will take care of the child's life and not leave it up to you. But we will not do that when it's you, because your autonomy is paramount. In halacha, that is nonsense. In halacha, if a patient is dying and we could save their life, and they refuse to have their life saved, we tie them down and save their life against their wishes. They're not free to throw away their life. We force them to accept life-saving treatment. If it's... fortunately, we're not taking any questions now. And we'll leave that. Because that's very problematic. That's very problematic because... that's uncalled for, that comment. That's very problematic for a number of reasons, not least of which is that you'll be acting in contravention of the legal system, and that's very problematic also, right? By the way, if you want a practical decision, practical ruling, when it comes to non-Jewish life, you should be at least as solicitous and careful as saving Jewish life. Apart from the value of human life, apart from that. But because there's added problems there, you can make a Kiddush Hashem by doing that. If anybody even thinks that you make distinctions between Jewish life and non-Jewish, we're completely invalid. So then you have a Chilul Hashem. There's so many issues over there. And it comes out in practice that when it comes to being cautious about treatment of non-Jews, sometimes for certain reasons, we are more cautious than even we are with Jews. Sometimes, by the way, there are added Torah reasons. Okay? For example, when it comes to aborting a non-Jewish fetus. Just for example, there the Torah law is that for non-Jews, that's homicide. That means the Torah values the life of a non-Jewish fetus in a much more serious way than it does a Jew. You understand that? In practice. That means when it comes to abortion for a Jew, it's a much less weighty question. It's a very serious question. And it's prohibited. But it's much less serious prohibition than it is for a non-Jew. However, when it comes to sterilization of a Jewish woman, there, it's a much more weighty question for a Jew than it is for a non-Jew. You have to know what the Torah says about these things. So there's a lot of complications in what you are raising. Let's not get into that now. However, the basic point I'm trying to make is, you see why we try not to take questions? Because every question is a whole field in its own right. The basic principle I'm making is that autonomy in halacha is not valid, with certain exceptions, which I'll try and share with you. But that my life's mine to do what I want to, it's invalid. Patient's life can be saved, we force them, and we save their life against their wishes. The problem here, before you go and do that literally, before you next go into your emergency room and tie somebody down and force them to save their life and give them blood, before you do that, you better be aware that this is modified by secular law, because there's a power law to observe the law of the land, so you're in trouble when you're acting against the law of the land, one. And two, it's modified by many other factors. For example, if forcing the patient to save their life involves a risk to the patient or pain, it's not so straightforward. It's not so straightforward. That means we're talking about the pure hypothetical situation that the patient needs something to save their life which involves no risk and no pain. And they simply, willfully, I wish to die with no reason at all. I don't want to live anymore. Are you with me? They've got an artery that's pumping blood, and in 10 minutes they're going to be dead. And all it involves is putting your thumb on it. Now that's not risky, and it's not painful. Are you with me? Your thorough obligation is you press that vessel until the patient starts bleeding. And the patient says, no, doc, I want to die. Right? I cut this artery, I want to die. You say nothing doing, and you press the artery while giving them healthy psychological counseling, and telling them that life's worthwhile, and why they shouldn't be doing this, etc. Right? That's what you do. Can I take 20 seconds as an aside? I think you'll enjoy this. This obligation is obligatory. You don't have to be a doctor for this. Right? If you can save a life. My late father, Oliver Sholem, had a friend who was a photographic dealer. He was a well-known photographic dealer in Johannesburg. And there were times when I was in his store when a very interesting conversation used to take place. He'd be standing behind the counter serving a customer and the phone would ring. He'd pick up the phone and I'd hear him saying like this, life's worth living, don't do it, step back in the window, don't jump. That's what he'd be saying. What's going on? Turns out like this. His phone number, listen carefully, his phone number was one digit different than Suicide Anonymous. Now, people standing on the ledge on the 32nd floor about to jump, they might be excused for getting a digit wrong, right, when they're dialing. Is that right? So he would get a lot of calls from people about to commit suicide. The last thing he could say was, wrong number. The last thing, when a guy standing on the ledge on the 32nd floor, and his last hope is Suicide Anonymous, and he hears, don't bother me, you've got the wrong number, you're going to jump, you know. And therefore, can you see the situation this guy was put in? What's he supposed to say? He became an expert suicide counselor, because he had to be. You hear that? So he'd pick up the phone, and the guy would say, I'm about to jump. And he would love to say, wrong number, I'm busy. He'd say, life's worth living, don't do it. And he was an expert. And I don't know how many lives he saved because of the wrong number. Can you imagine that? Anyway, that's your obligation as a Jew, right? Okay, now. Maybe that's why the photographic unit has developed negatives. Anyway, so now let's continue. So autonomy doesn't hold any weight from a loving perspective. Are you with me? Because it's not the patient's life anyway. It's not yours. I mentioned this morning to some of those in my halakhic group, a very interesting application of this, that the Radbaz, very, very beautiful thing to know, the Radbaz, one of the early authorities, raises a very interesting halakhic question. Very interesting halakhic question, which has medical applications, although he didn't say it in a medical context, and I'll share it with you, it's beautiful to know. He asks the following question. In Jewish law, in the laws of testimony, those who are with me this morning will forgive my mentioning it briefly again. In the laws of testimony, the halacha is you may not incriminate yourself. In the laws of claims, of speaking in court, the halacha is that evidence that is prejudicial to yourself is inadmissible. Okay? Ain't Adam making us more rashi. You're not allowed to make yourself. You may not say anything in court that is negative about yourself. In America, that's known as the Fifth Amendment. The Fifth Amendment is that you cannot be required to say anything that is in your own disinterest. By the way, the halachic principle goes much further than the Fifth Amendment. Because in America, the Fifth Amendment means that you cannot be required to say anything that can be used in evidence against you, but you may if you wish to. You can confess. You can confess if you wish. In halacha, you're not allowed to confess. You may not voluntarily confess. You may not say you committed a crime. You're not allowed to do it. And if you say it in court, it's expunged from the record. It's inadmissible. Are you with me? You're not allowed to do it. Why? Well, we have to discuss it, but you're not allowed to. Your own testimony will go so far as to harm your statement. The man makes a statement in which he states that a certain crime took place and that he was party to the crime. We will believe the statement about the rest of the crime, but not about him. There's a classic case where a man says, when a man gives testimony that another man committed a homosexual act. Let's say a man comes to court in Beijing and he testifies that another man committed a homosexual act and he states that he was party to the act and he was a voluntary participant. The halacha states that we believe his statement about the other man and we don't hear it about him. That just gets expunged from the record. His testimony remains valid about the other party, but the part that makes him, right, is just expunged. It's inadmissible. Why? Because you're not valid to say testimony about yourself.
By the way, that applies to your relatives, certainly your wife. Husband and wife cannot give testimony. In secular law, they can. In Jewish law, husband and wife are considered as one being. You're not allowed to say testimony. And about yourself, you're your closest relative, you're not allowed to say testimony. The problem is that in financial matters, you are allowed to incriminate yourself. In a civil matter, where finance is involved, where the punishment, the judgment against you will be financial, you are believed to say negative testimony about yourself. And that's an obvious contradiction. The Radbaz, great famous halakhic authority, points out this contradiction. What's going on? If the Torah does not believe you to say evidence about yourself in matters like that are capital and corporal, where the punishment will be lashes or a death sentence, because you're not considered objective when it comes to testimony about yourself, so how come your testimony is accepted financially? If you're not objective, you're not objective. And on the other hand, if you want to say that you are believed to give objective testimony about yourself financially because you consider to be able to put aside your vested interest, right, and you can testify, so then why can't you testify in matters that are capital and corporal? What's going on? Either the Torah should believe you in general as a witness against yourself, or it shouldn't. Why is there a distinction whether the outcome is going to be financial harm to yourself or the outcome is going to be capital or corporal? You hear the question? It's an obvious question, and it's a beautiful question. You hear it, gentlemen? Ladies and gentlemen. The Radbaz answers a classic answer, which is very beautiful. It's one of those classic areas of halakha, which is technically halakhic, and yet has immense ramifications in spiritual and hashkafic, not non-halakhic matters. And he answers like this. The beautiful answer. The reason that you are allowed to give testimony against yourself in matters that involve finances is because your money belongs to you. None of yours. Hashem has given you financial possessions and he's put them in your control. You want to give them away? You're welcome. You want to testify in a financial matter where you'll be fined and you'll lose money? It's up to you. You want to pay away the money? You're free to. But in a matter where you're going to get lashes or a death sentence, your soul's not yours. You're not free to say, sure, I'll take lashes. This body that you want to get pounded, punished and tortured and maybe killed, that's not yours. That's not yours. That's a trusteeship that's being loaned to you to take care of. Do you understand? It's not yours to say, oh, I'll throw it away, I'll get it tortured and punished and killed. You're not free to do that. It's not yours. You're a trustee being appointed over this thing. What a beautiful answer. But your money, no, nothing doing. When it comes to your money, it's given into your possession. You want to throw it away, you can throw it away. You might be transgressing certain things if you do that, but hey, it's yours. Are you with me? And therefore, you want to incriminate yourself in a financial matter, go right ahead. You want to obligate yourself, whether it's objective or not, you'd have to pay the guy $10,000. Go right ahead. But you want to say that you're going to confess in a matter where the punishment is going to be corporal or capital, they're going to kill you for that. Hey, it's not yours. Your life's not yours. It's a very, very beautiful idea. And its application in halakhic medical matters, as we've been saying, is that you are not free to desist. And therefore, autonomy, okay, generally speaking, not valid. I'll try and share with you in the course of this series of discussions where autonomy is very valid halakhically. But in general, the default position is what I want to emphasize now, not valid. And the other three you'll find to be equally invalid. Beneficence, for example, meaning that the medical effort here has to be for the benefit of the patient. Why is that not valid halakhically? Because obviously it depends on what you call benefit. Isn't it? Obviously. They say that putting the patient out of his misery and killing him, that might be his benefit. Are you with me? Beneficence, of course, is valid after you've defined accurately what's called for the patient's good. Are you with me, gentlemen? What for his good? They may rule that not telling that the patient has AIDS, not telling somebody, his spouse, that the patient has AIDS, is that good or bad? It depends. Is it good for him? Is it good for the spouse? We have to first define what's called good. But in Torah, we've got a Torah definition of what's called good. Of course, you have to act in the best interest of the patient and everybody else and yourself. But first, you need an objective criteria about what's called good. So therefore, to come up with a concept called what's for the patient good is going to be subservient to what you then define as being what's called good. There's a very well-known heart transplant surgeon. Very well known. I'm certainly not going to quote any names. But he comes from a certain country, in a certain hemisphere, where the first heart transplant was done. And so we're not going to mention any names. But this man, is well known publicly. I've heard him say it publicly, and he's well known, writes a newspaper column. He publicly espouses the position that we should actively kill people when they're suffering. In fact, in the last time I heard him speak about it, the way he put it was, we do that for dogs who are suffering. Why don't we show the same kindness to people? That means when a dog's suffering, we'll kill him. Therefore, why do we not show the same kindness to people who are suffering? Let's kill him. Right? Now, he publicly espouses such a position. Okay. Now, halakhically, right, and he says, his argument is that's for the good of the patient. It's a kindness, and the euthanasia argument is that argument, isn't it? Then why are we going to kill this patient? because it's for their best interest to take them out of suffering. Lately, there's another argument creeping in as well, by the way, which you should be very, very well aware of, and that is, they're going to kill them because they're too expensive to keep alive. That's why. Because their life isn't worth anything anyway, and it costs society too much. The first version of that argument is, because we could use the money to save somebody else's life, it could be saved. And the next step is, too darn expensive. That's what we're seeing now, huh? If you don't believe me, look in the literature. You'll see that every article in the medical journals now comes out, the first paragraph has a justification for why we're doing this study. This is an important study, because lots of patients are affected, and a lot of money is involved. And then they make a calculation of how much money has been spent in the United States in the last year on treatment for this particular illness. In halacha, money is irrelevant. Irrelevant when it comes to saving lives. Irrelevant in a personal situation when it comes to saving lives. Non-maleficence, the third principle, that we do things that are considered to be not harmful to the patient, again, can you see, is subject to the same problem. We first have to define what's called the patient's harm, what's called their benefit, what's called their harm, right? And sometimes not only the patient, it's the family. I have one of my close relatives is a general practitioner who, we were working in the same practice together. Fortunately for me, I was not the doctor on duty when this happened. Right? This patient happened to be my brother, this particular doctor happened to be his patient. The patient came in with the following problem. I'm going to show you what's going on here. This doctor practices in a religious community, and he's got one family that's not religious. One family that prays him, they come from another place, different community, and he agrees to treat the family. Right? They're not religious at all. Jewish, but they're not religious. One day the man comes to see him with the following problem. He says, "Doctor, I just got back from overseas. Been overseas for 3 weeks. Got back a couple of weeks ago." What's the problem? He's now got a urethral discharge. He has venereal disease. Okay? A communicable venereal disease. What happened? He was overseas for 3 weeks. And he didn't spend every day at the conference table. Or every evening. And now he's infected. The problem is, what's the problem? My brother, this doctor examined him, and he turns out to be, right, he sends off the test, etc. It's quite an easily treatable problem, that if he gives him the correct antibiotics in the correct dosage, the man will be fine. The problem is you need to treat his wife as well, and he hasn't told his wife. And if you don't treat the wife, there's a treatment failure because she's going to reinfect him. Now, he hasn't told his wife about this, and he's not about to tell her. That's what he did while he was overseas for 3 weeks. So he comes to ask his general practitioner, maybe you could give him the kind of antibiotics that he can put in his wife's coffee. Or maybe there's some way he can give her an injection sort of by accident or something. You know, how's he going to... You hear the problem? You hear the moral problem? So what's the doctor supposed to do? Treat the patient? Not only is he going to fail here, but he's going to infect the wife. And the wife, if she doesn't get treated, she's going to come to harm. She might get pelvic inflammatory disease over here and become infertile and suffer serious harm, serious damage. It's conceivable. On the other hand, if he calls the wife and tells her what's doing, you know, it's kind of a marital explosion. I mean, do you know what's going on here? On the other hand, can he... So I'm not going to go into what he did. I'm not going to go into now at the present time. No, that's not relevant. At the moment, that's not relevant. The point is that what do you talk? You talk about what would I've done is also not relevant at this particular point in time.
Would you mention the solution to
the problem that came in at the time? This is not our subject today. But one would seek there the solution that is both kindly and humane and technically correct as well. Might involve counselling. Let's deal with that a little bit. The point is that the problem was taken care of. But here you have an awfully difficult time defining who's benefit and who's benefit and who's not being benefit and who's being harmed yet, understand? And who's autonomy? I mean, it is so tangled up in those questions that the principles are almost useless if you don't have an absolute standard. And fourthly, of course, you have justice. Justice, again, is going to be totally irrelevant because you first have to decide what's called just. What's called just? Individual or society? The AIDS patient or his consort? Who, or both of them? Or the doctor? What's called justice? You're not to treat a patient with, you know, I'm an orthopedic surgeon, not to treat this patient who's got AIDS. It's almost inevitable that I'm going to cut myself, I'm going to stick my finger. I don't think there's a surgeon on earth who hasn't cut himself, right, during surgery, especially when it comes to orthopedic and vascular surgery. So who comes first, the patient, the surgeon, the society, what, you know, and how do you weigh the risk? So justice, and what's called just, is going to have to be subject to, so in a system where we call it justice, And every year we redefine what's called just. This year we call euthanasia murder. Next year we write it into law and we call it now just and moral. So what is justice worth? Are you listening? If you don't have a system outside of this, hops back to our introduction with which we began yesterday in terms of... So in summary, we're going to leave it there for today. The secular criteria need to be assessed from a thorough perspective as to where they are valid and where they're not valid. We have to look at each of these criteria from a thorough perspective, and then we'll find places where they're all valid, but with a standard that informs them, right? Then we can start to see. Now, what I'd like to do next is go into where autonomy is a valid criteria, where the patient does get to choose in terms of saving their own life. There are situations where the patient is free to say, thank you, but I won't take therapy, I'd rather die, or I will accept therapy and live. We do have such halakhic cases, but they need to be defined very carefully halakhically. They do not overlap. At least there is an overlap, but they're not synonymous with the secular cases. And this will stop there. One question and we'll stop for today. Yes.
So what happens if you have two value systems that are in tension with each other that conflict? So if I want to be a good halakhic Jew, and I also want to be a responsible citizen of the U.S., where the democracy allows it so that...
That's a good question. Good practical question. Not only the U.S. What about Israel?
Right.
Israel does not follow Torah law either.
Right.
Or any non-liberal state for that matter. Right. In any state, what are you going to do in the law of the land?
Not necessarily taking a liberal, a moral position by saying that you really have the freedom to do it to the bodies.
I hear the question.
So we're not saying endorsing abortion.
No. I hear the question.
Okay.
The answer is like this, that there is a principle to obey the law of the land. That's one. That is negated when it's in contravention with Torah law. When the law of the land says, pull the plug and let the patient die, and Torah says that's murder, nothing doing. Nothing doing, not allowed to do it. Can you step aside and say, I recuse myself from this case. I'm not valid to be the doctor here, get somebody else. Girl comes to you for an abortion in circumstances where it's halakhically invalid. There are certainly cases where you can say, you don't have to stand there and stop anybody else doing it. There are realities where you can say, listen, I'm not allowed to do it because of my religious convictions, find somebody else. And this itself, all the ins and outs of what you're allowed to do and where you have to put yourself in the way, when you have to stand aside, when there is a resuscitation attempt, and after 5 minutes all the doctors standing around say, well, it's hopeless anyway. And you know that you should be continuing. What are you going to do? How are you going to motivate them? How are you going to... These are all very, very serious problems. And as you go through medical school, we'll need to discuss them. I'll just give you one natural...
Where you're voting for a president, and one is pro-choice and one is not pro-choice.
That's a very complicated...
The same principle that protects...
That's a much less...
...safely in the land, free...
That's a very, very complex question. We've got enough trouble before we get to that. Let me just end with a nutshell concept of your immediate question, and it's like this. I just, without getting into the halakhic ramifications, I want to share with you a practical observation, and that is like this. Fortunately for us, in every single case that I can think of, I mean, you've probably come up with some weird cases that I haven't thought of, but in almost every conceivable case where there's a conflict between the halakhic position and the secular position, okay, you have two things going for you. One, you spoke about Western liberal societies. They still do respect, or at least claim to respect, your religious convictions. Which means that in Western liberal societies, you are respected and considered to be within your rights when you stand aside and say, my religious principles do not allow me to do this, and therefore I cannot do this abortion, I cannot assist
in the U.S., where the democracy allows it so that...
That's a good question. Good practical question. Not out of the U.S. What about Israel?
Right.
Israel does not follow Torah law either.
Right.
Or any non-liberal state for that matter.
Right.
In any state, what are you going to do in the law of the land?
Not necessarily taking a moral position by saying that you really have the freedom to do it to the bodies.
I hear the question.
So we're not saying endorsing abortion.
I hear the question.
Okay.
The answer is like this, that there is a principle to obey the law of the land. That's one. That is negated when it's in contravention with Torah law. When the law of the land says, pull the plug and let the patient die, and Torah says that's murder, nothing doing. Nothing doing, not allowed to do it. Can you step aside and say, I recuse myself from this case. I'm not valid to be the doctor here, get somebody else. Girl comes to you for an abortion in circumstances where it's halakhically invalid. There are certainly cases where you can say, you don't have to stand there and stop anybody else doing it. There are realities where you can say, listen, I'm not allowed to do it because of my religious convictions, find somebody else. And this itself, all the ins and outs of what you're allowed to do and where you have to put yourself in the way, when you have to stand aside, when there is a resuscitation attempt, and after 5 minutes all the doctors standing around say, well, it's hopeless anyway. And you know that you should be continuing. What are you going to do? How are you going to motivate them? How are you going to... These are all very, very serious problems. And as you go to medical school, we'll need to discuss them. I'll just give you one natural...
When you're voting for a president, and one is pro-choice and one is not pro-choice.
That's a very complex.
Same principle that protects.
Yes. That's a much less
safely in the land free.
That's a very, very complex question. We've got enough trouble before we get to that. Let me just end with a nutshell concept of your immediate question, and it's like this. I just, without getting into the logic ramifications, I want to share with you a practical observation, and that is like this. Fortunately for us, in every single case that I can think of, I mean, you've probably come up with some weird cases that I haven't thought of, but in almost every conceivable case where there's a conflict between the halachic position and the secular position, okay, you have two things going for you. One, liberal, you spoke about Western liberal societies. They still do respect, or at least claim to respect, your religious convictions, which means that in Western liberal societies, you are respected and considered to be within your rights when you stand aside and say, my religious principles do not allow me to do this, and therefore I cannot do this abortion, I cannot assist at this abortion, I cannot switch off the ventilator, I'm sorry but I can't do it. They will say, we respect your religious principles, although we may disagree, and they'll find somebody else to be the executioner. That's what will happen, first of all. Secondly, in almost, again, every case that I can think of, the halachic position is much more extreme towards saving life than the secular position. So that not only are you having to demand your religious freedom, but also you can claim a more moral position. In other words, when they want you to switch off the respirator, the argument will become your religious conviction. Fortunately, we are always on the side that is pro-life. We are saying that patient's life is worth it, even though you think not. You understand? And therefore, it's much easier to hold that position. They are in a much more awkward situation when they want to switch off the respirator. So they can't attack you on moral grounds. You're doing what constitutes your religious position, and, you understand, you're taking a more extreme moral position. If you were the one who switched off the machine, imagine Torah required you to switch off the machine.